Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The theme today is glyphosate, Monsanto, and the corruption of science. And now to our guest from Hawaii via Zoom, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, S-E-N-E-F-F. She's a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. She holds a bachelor's degree in biology with a minor in food nutrition, a master's degree in engineering, and a PhD in electrical engineering and computer science, all from MIT. She's authored over 36 peer-reviewed journal papers on topics relating to human disease and also nutritional deficiencies and toxic exposures. Over the years, her approach has focused specifically on the herbicide glyphosate, better known as Roundup, and the mineral sulfur. She divides her time between her home in Hawaii and her work at MIT. She's the author of a recently released book, Toxic Legacy, How the Weed Killer Glyphosate is Destroying Our Health and the Environment, which some have compared to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Her website is Stephanie, that's S-T-E-P-H-A-N-I-E, Seneff, S-E-N-E-F-F dot net. Nice to have you with us today.
So great to be here. Thank you.
We're going to talk about a couple of issues that unfortunately rarely are discussed by the mainstream or even the alternative media. And I'm looking at the larger picture, and that is the corruption of science and how major corporations, institutional corporations, legacy corporations, they've been around for dozens or even 100 years, seem to get a free pass whenever they make a mistake, and even when it's shown in courts of law or investigations that they knowingly released something that was toxic upon a public. They pay a fine, and there's no jail time. Their reputations are not only not harmed, but frequently, as in the case of Merck and Vioxx, which minimally killed 100,000 people over a five-year period, the stock actually went up, and the head of the company got a raise. And I'm thinking, only in America could you kill 100,000 people and get a raise. And so now we're going to look at the background on Monsanto, but more importantly on this commonly used, still in use, glyphosate, not only here but also in other countries such as in India, because we tend to have this bad habit of when something is ultimately banned in the United States, we just market it elsewhere without any due warnings. So over the years, studies have been published and released about glyphosate's risks and toxicities to human and animal health in the environment. At the same time, there have been highly orchestrated efforts to marginalize and discredit these studies and their authors, especially if they get published in peer-reviewed journals. In particular, I'm thinking of the damning Dr. Cerulini studies out of France. It's not an exaggeration to state that glyphosate is today's DDT, which was first promoted by the Swiss company Geigy, but later manufactured by about a dozen companies, and not surprisingly, Monsanto was among them. I want to get into the health risks, but first, chemically speaking, what is glyphosate? And second, when it was invented, what were its prime commercial applications? And before Monsanto started to develop and manufacture the chemical, what were its human and environmental health risks, at least known at that time? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you. Yes, so glyphosate is the active ingredient in Roundup, and people are familiar with Roundup. They use it often to kill the weeds in their walkways, kill the dandelions in their yard. It's considered to be perfectly safe for humans, a wonderful herbicide, kills all plants except those that have been engineered to resist it, and is practically harmless to humans. So it's been, U.S. uses more per person than any other country in the world, but it's been increasingly used around the world, especially since it came out from under the patent. So today, huge amounts of glyphosate are used. A total, I think, of something like 10 billion kilograms of glyphosate have been sprayed all around the world as of today, and continuing to go up dramatically. So if it is really safe to us, then it's a great boon for agriculture. And certainly the U.S. government wants to believe that. Seralinis. So I should say just that it was first identified as something that could strip metals from pipes. And so it was patented originally, I think, in 1961 by a company called Stouffer, I believe, that as a pipe cleaning agent. And it wasn't until it was sort of by accident, I think, that somebody spilled some glyphosate on some plant and it died. And they thought, oh, maybe this might work as a weed. And Monsanto then patented as a weed killer in 1968. Much later, in 2000, it was actually patented as a microbicide, so as a sort of an antibiotic that it could kill microbes. And that is indeed true. And that's part of its big problem, because it messes up our gut microbiome in a big way. And as people are realizing more and more today, the gut microbiome is often at the root of many, many different diseases that we're suffering from and that are dramatically rising in our population today because of our disrupted gut microbiome. And I think glyphosate plays a major role in that. So let's see, did I answer all your questions? That was a big question that you asked. It originally showed up in the United States, I think around 1974, it was available on the market. Monsanto did some studies, and they were done in a very sleazy way with a lot of, first of all, some restrictions on what you could do in the studies or what was okay to do that caused people not to notice that it was so toxic. So they did some tricks that allowed them, and also some corruption was involved. But they decided that if it didn't appear to be too damaging at high doses, you didn't have to look at lower doses. And that's not true for an endocrine disruptor, and glyphosate has been shown to be an endocrine disruptor. Number two, they said, well, you could just go for 3 months. If you didn't see any toxicity after 3 months in an animal study, then you could quit. That was fine. You were done. Seralini was the one with this extremely important study in 2012. And that was right when I got interested in glyphosate, by the way. It was right around the time when Seralini's paper came out. Remarkable paper where they basically repeated an experiment that Monsanto had done to gain approval. And Monsanto had stopped at 3 months. They exposed rats to low doses of glyphosate over a 3 month period. Seralini decided to do that over the entire lifespan of the rats. And so by 3 months, things were looking good. By 4 months, you started to see problems. By the end of their lifespan, the females had massive mammary tumors. The males were suffering from kidney damage and liver damage. Both genders were suffering from reproductive issues. So there were a lot of problems. And there was also early death. So they showed that with a low dose, it was a low dose of glyphosate over the entire lifespan caused enormous troubles to these rats. And that paper was very controversial. The industry pressured, got it retracted. It was republished in a different journal. So it still holds as a publication. And it's interesting because it kind of marks a break point. When you look at the studies after 2012, before 2012, nobody was studying low dose exposure because they figured if it's not toxic at high doses, why should you bother? And they thought this is such a great chemical. It's safe. You don't need to study, just wasting money. Once he showed that low dose exposure issue, More and more studies started coming out after 2012 of exposures of various animals to low-dose glyphosate, showing significant damage, just as he had shown. So, and then starting to see a lot of evidence of endocrine disruption. So many papers are coming out even the last few years. People are definitely interested in studying glyphosate again now as a consequence, I believe, of Seralini's seminal paper that really kind of changed the look and feel of glyphosate as far as, you know, toxicologists considering it to be a worthy chemical to study, because it's not over yet. It's not safe, you know, and it hasn't been proven that it's safe. And so people are really realizing now that we've been misled. And the government, the U.S. government still thinks it's perfectly safe. And they think, you know, it's you don't have to measure how much is in the food, but it turns out it's all over the food supply. So other people are measuring glyphosate in food and finding it in high concentrations in many foods that are very popular with the children, like oatmeal cookies and Oreo cookies and goldfish crackers and Cheerios, which is such a popular finger food for the kids. All of these, you know, foods that kids eat in large quantities are heavy doses of glyphosate. And so, and not just GMO, I should say. Also, people often think, if I buy non-GMO, I'll be safe. There is, in fact, a major percentage of the GMOs that are out there, genetically modified crops, are modified to be resistant to glyphosate. And that's been a big boon in agriculture because you can just spray the glyphosate all over the crop and it doesn't die and you kill the weeds. So very efficient agriculture makes our food very cheap. Actually, the United States pays a lot less per capita, per income, on food compared to most other countries in the world, because our food is grown so efficiently, but we are in the meantime destroying our health and also destroying the health of the soil and of the animals. You know, the whole ecosystem is being very greatly harmed by glyphosate. And it's just something that people aren't aware of. They don't think of glyphosate as a chemical you should worry about because we've been taught that it's so safe. So that makes it very, very dangerous. It's pervasive. It's considered generally safe. And people use it carelessly for that reason. And it's all over the food supply. It's also in the air, in the water. So you can't avoid glyphosate if you live in this country.
Let's take a look at some of the science behind it. Historically, there's a very close relationship between the major companies, no matter what company it is, and various regulatory agencies, in this case, the USDA and the FDA. And so when a person goes, let's say a legislator has a hearing and they bring in an expert, generally these experts are coming from think tanks. And the average American doesn't realize that we have thousands of think tanks, and some are legitimate, but some are purely political and others are purely economic driven, where they take a university professor, I'm sure they've done it with people from MIT and certainly I know of Harvard, and they will pay them a lot of money, either through research, funding their research or stipends. And the person goes before Congress and says, I've looked at the scientific literature and this product is not harmful, and that ends it. I mean, that's it's over. I don't care what kind of evidence you have as a consumer advocate, you're not going to get much traction. I know because Rachel Carson got no traction, and those of us, myself included, who helped carry her work forward and had demonstrations all over the country on DDT, sometimes we'd have five people show up at a rally. Nobody believed that DDT was bad. We even realized, gee whiz, we grew up where it was sprayed on children and sprayed in lawns, sprayed a swimming pool, so it couldn't be bad. They wouldn't allow something bad to infect us in some way, adversely. But then something unusual happened. Any lawsuit against Monsanto, and they were highly litigious, they would sue companies and farmers. They were just known as playing hardball nonstop. They had that reputation. But they were also known to go after anyone who challenged their credibility and hence their profitability. And they always seem to have a long list of highly credentialed, well-pedigreed scientists or physicians or professors who would be their media spokesperson. And they could always refer, well, look, such and such said in this journal, in this peer review article, that, you know, there's no damage there. These are just a bunch of nut job, you know, environmentalists who have nothing better to do. Then a Freedom of Information Act, I believe it was, by a person got thousands and thousands of documents from Monsanto that showed all these cancers that internal documents showed that it created. They had hidden this, much like the tobacco industry had never lost a lawsuit because nobody could absolutely prove that smoking contributed to lung cancer or even emphysema. They all lied. All seven top company heads of the tobacco industry lied before Congress. Now, at the same time, the FDA and the patent office knew the truth. They knew that tobacco was addictive. Now, also in these patents and other research, governmental agencies do frequently have evidence, but it's proprietary, so they won't release it. So the health of a community is less important than the proprietary profitability of a patent or patents. And so the government wasn't on our side. But that information, when it came out, and we were the first to broadcast it, it just went down all these different cancers, and I'm thinking the lawsuit's going to start, and certainly after their lawsuit started. Once they lost that one lawsuit, then now I think there's about 40 or 50,000 people that have sued them. They've set aside $10 billion plus to settle those lawsuits, Bayer, the company in Sweden, Switzerland that bought Monsanto. So let's take some time, if you would, and go through whatever evidence has existed to show that they knew all along that this product was toxic and that was kept from the American public. And anyone who supported them should have known it was toxic if they chose to do more in-depth investigation into this.
Right. Yeah. So, in fact, Carrie Gillam is a really good person to know about and to read her books. She's written two books, I think, so far, showing all the shenanigans that have been going on and how much has been happening. That is fraud, really fraud. And their whole setup with their studies was done very sloppily. But even so, they did find evidence. But then they did a lot of shenanigans, like swapping in. They changed the control group from using some mice from some earlier era back when they were being exposed to DDT. So they basically did some shady things to try to get around the evidence that it was causing cancer. And Anthony Samsel is one that talks a lot about this. He was able to, through a Freedom of Information Act, he was able to get a huge pile of stuff from Monsanto. And it's not searchable, and he wasn't allowed to, they had to sign a document that said he wasn't allowed to show it to anybody, which is quite interesting to me. That I'm surprised they were able to do that, but he has it in his home, and he's rummaged through this, and he's found a lot of evidence of things like cancer that were showing up in Monsanto's own studies, but they managed to find ways to hide that evidence in the way that they reported it. And so now, of course, there's a lot of new studies coming out that are showing, and in particular, cancer, as you say, cancer has been a big thing because it's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in particular that has really stood out as Monsanto glyphosate has been shown now in published papers to have a correlation, to have a causative effect on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And there are so many people who have used only glyphosate. So they don't have, the farmers are harder to prove because they're exposed to so many different things that you can always say something else caused it. But there was a study on farmers that showed that a statistically significant correlation between glyphosate usage and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And then they did a bunch of, you know, mathematics to correct for everything else that you're exposed to. And almost everything else there, correlation went down, but glyphosate's correlation went up after they corrected for the other exposures, meaning that it really stood out as a causative factor in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in these farmers. But mostly farmers can't succeed in the lawsuit because there are so many other chemicals that can always be blamed. That's one of the tricks these chemical companies play, is to blame the other chemicals. But there are now many, many people, thousands of people who are suing Monsanto or Bayer for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as a consequence of exposures to glyphosate. And many of these are people at home who used it on their lawns and then got sick. And there were three individual jury-based lawsuits that were successful one after the other. That was such an exciting period for me. When I remember when that first lawsuit succeeded, Lee Johnson, let's see, it's a Dwayne Lee Johnson was the name of the fellow. He was took care of schoolyards, and glyphosate was the only chemical he used, and he used it on these schoolyards, which is also really sad to think about. So he succeeded, and then there were two others who succeeded with large sums awarded by a jury, later reduced to smaller amounts. And now there's this class action lawsuit, which Bayer had originally tried to deal to get a deal for, I think, $11 billion to settle the class action lawsuit. It's still ongoing because there's certain aspects of the deal that the lawyers don't like. And so there's some pushback. And I don't think it's actually happened yet. And now they've just added $4.5 billion more to the pot to help to solve this huge problem that they face right now with all these lawsuits on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Doesn't it tell you something that the FDA and USDA have not moved to ban glyphosate or Roundup in the United States?
I'm very frustrated by that. And I will say I'm extremely proud of Mexico. And I don't know if you've heard, but Mexico has decided to phase out glyphosate entirely by 2024. And the United States is putting a lot of pressure on them to try to get them to back down by sort of threatening to restrict trade and this sort of thing. So far, Mexico has stood firm. By 2024, they're going to not allow glyphosate use in Mexico, which is really, really awesome. I'm hoping that having a neighbor next door with that position is going to cause a lot of people in the United States to wake up and think, hey, maybe this chemical is toxic, you know. And the other thing is that Bayer has decided to not sell Roundup with glyphosate. They're going to probably make a new formulation with equally toxic other chemicals, but they're going to take glyphosate out of the formulation that they sell to the United States by 2023. So So that's also very, very interesting. They basically said because the lawsuits are mostly from the residential sales of glyphosate, that's because the farmers don't have, can't make a good case. So they're just going to restrict and not allow glyphosate in the products they sell to the residential community. But they're still going to allow glyphosate to be sold in the United States for the agricultural industry, which is where the big, big problem lies, I think, because we're all being poisoned by the food. Fortunately, we have a certified organic label, and that is very helpful. And when I shop at the grocery store, I always look for that label. I won't buy the product if it doesn't have a certified organic label. And it's not perfect. And as long as they're obeying the rules, they can't use glyphosate on certified organic. But some of the products still do contain small amounts of glyphosate because it's so pervasive, because it's in the rain. You know, it could be the neighbor's farm. It's really impossible to keep glyphosate out completely in this country because it's so pervasive. But you'll get much lower levels in general on certified organic, and even zero. I mean, many of the certified organic foods do not test positive for glyphosate. But I think that's the most important thing you can do for your health, is to buy only certified organic when you shop at the grocery store.
A larger issue that's partly legal and partly philosophical is that we were having people on the program. I did a documentary, you're in it, called Seeds of Death, which, by the way, just as an aside, none of your PBS stations will play this, but Rocky Mountain PBS did in Denver. They played it 84 times because it was so popular, 84 times, even though the Koch brothers are one of the supporters out there, and the person, Sherry Bernson, who is the program director, took a lot of heat, but she said, I've drawn a line here that people need to know how bad genetically engineered foods are. And one of the arguments at that time was that there would be an organic farm, true story, on one side of a road and a regular commercial farm on the other, and genetically engineered seeds that were owned by Monsanto were being sprayed on one side, and birds, wind, can pick up a seed and carry it. And so Monsanto would send in detectives, their own, and much like the Pinkerton detectives of old, and they would go on someone's property and they would find some soil that had some genetically engineered seed in, and then they would sue that person. Frequently.
Right, I know about that.
I mean, ruthless. What does this tell us about the corporate, moral, or ethical culture of Monsanto?
That's just incredible. And there was this Percy, I know Percy was his first name, and I've forgotten his last name, a Canadian farmer who took them all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court on exactly that situation. He had an organic farm, and the seeds had blown in. So they found the crops growing in his, among his crops, and they accused him of planting seeds that he hadn't, planting seeds he hadn't paid for, I suppose is what it was, but he was not allowed to have those seeds. And it was a huge fight. He didn't even want them, of course. And he was stuck with them because you can't kill it. You know, if you're using glyphosate, you can't kill it with glyphosate because it's so hardy. So those seeds are really problematic and they get around. And then, of course, it's just awful to think about being sued for something that where you had no control over what was happening. And then they can actually destroy these farmers with these lawsuits because they don't have the kind of resources they need to fight back. It is really such a criminal act. You just can't imagine. I have a hard time imagining these people, the people that are running these companies that are poisoning the whole world and destroying the ecosystem. And how do they sleep at night? It really puzzles me that they are willing to do this, you know, without having a sense of shame or.
Well, but look at all the companies that gave us asbestos, that gave us copper coil 7 and the intrauterine device, which harmed a lot of women. The synthetic hormone replacement therapy, putting 10 million women at risk each year of ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, heart attacks, strokes, and dementia. Think of over the last 40 years how many women have ended up with those conditions because they took synthetic hormone replacement therapy rather than natural bioidentical hormone therapy. Think of all the people who ended up with Agent Orange. Think of all the vets, 3.4 million American vets who served in Vietnam, came back who were sick. Think of all the people who were exposed to depleted uranium. In all these instances, and there's 1,000 more examples, The government never takes responsibility, denies a problem. Corporate makers deny all responsibility. And decades go by before some time in the future there is some reckoning. But long after it should have and long after it was time, what does that tell you about government regulatory agencies being captured, the media being fully captured on all these issues? What does that tell us?
I know, and I have to say the Sackler family, too, because I just heard about this. The Sackler family got off with a very, very light, they had us fine, and that nobody in there is going to go to jail, and they're going to just go about business as usual with this opioid drug crisis. That's another example, a recent example of this kind of behavior. It's mind-boggling, actually. You know, I have a hard time understanding that our species has individuals who are able to carry on like this and to be destroying so much on the earth, and not just the human destruction, but also, you know, the bees and the butterflies and the dolphins. I mean, just so many animals are being harmed by the chemicals that we're putting out there. And all of those individuals who are in charge of making those chemicals are at fault. And they seem to be able collectively to go about their business as if everything's fine, despite the fact that they're producing a product that's poisoning the earth. It actually doesn't make sense to me that there are people like that. I feel like our genes should prevent such a thing from happening, for someone to have no remorse and no concern for the damage that they're doing so extensively to so much of the earth. I don't understand it. And of course, the government is largely to blame as well, because they go along with it and they don't pass the laws that could regulate these things. So it's up to the individual to take individual responsibility to try to avoid. And of course, that becomes impossible in a world like we have today, where especially in the United States, where glyphosate is pervasive everywhere. So even if you want to be conscientious about avoiding it, you really can't do it. You can't avoid it completely. And that's also very frustrating. And that's true for a lot of other chemicals that are, of course, polluting the air. You know, we have toxic air from many different things. Glyphosate is one of them. And you have to breathe, you know. So if you live in a place where the air is toxic, you can't avoid it. That's very, very frustrating for the individual. And the government really should be taking responsibility if they care about their citizens and want them to be healthy.
Keep in mind that the Sackler family was accused of causing the preventable death of 500,000 Americans. They were not penalized on these immoral profits. They were allowed to keep their profits. And as a result, they're one of America's wealthiest families, multi-billions they still own at the cost of 500,000 American lives. That is where we've gone. Now, coming back to Monsanto for a few more moments here, you are aware, and could you share what your awareness is, that Monsanto, as other corporations have done, had a group of people who would be hired to go out and try to destroy the reputations of any of its critics. And they did this with Seralini. He sued and won, by the way.
Oh, that's great. Yes. And they've done it with Carrie Gillum as well. They've definitely tried to discredit her, and they've tried to discredit Anthony Sampson and myself as well. They basically hire people too, as you probably know. People get paid to push back on evidence that glyphosate causes harm, and they deny. They just basically say that we're fanatics that don't know what we're talking about and this sort of thing. The glyphosate's perfectly safe, and these people who are criticizing it are somehow, basically they want to discredit us. They want to believe that we're just sort of exaggerating the situation and we don't really have a problem and that the chemical is perfectly fine and we're just a little crazy, I suppose, is what they're saying.
I noticed that you mentioned that glyphosate interferes with plants and microorganisms. Shikimic acid, which I know is an important biochemical metabolite in plants, and this is important for maintaining a healthy microbiome in a human's gut that eats these plants. But this acid is also known to reduce platelet aggregation, which is a huge problem with the spike proteins, both for SARS-2 virus and the COVID-19 vaccines. And during a recent webinar, I told viewers just 2 weeks ago that if you must get the COVID vaccine, that they should replenish their The particular acid with a tea made from star anise, fennel, and fresh pine needles, which, to my knowledge, are the best sources of this shikimicotic acid. Would you speak on the importance of this metabolite and the health consequences of glyphosate disrupting its pathway? And then do you see any adverse synergistic effects of the RNA vaccines may have in people with higher concentrations of glyphosate in their body? It's just a hypothesis, but it's interesting since you mentioned everybody has glyphosate in our tissues, even if you eat organic, because it's so ubiquitous and the chemical can float in the air. It's not like you spray it and it stays only where it's sprayed. It can be in our water and our soil and the air.
Yeah, so that's a lot. That's a huge question. But let me start with the shikimate pathway, because that is the a critical pathway in plants. It's essential to most plants. All plants, actually, are affected by glyphosate because it messes up that pathway, blocks it, basically. And that pathway is extremely interesting because it produces metabolites that are precursors to all kinds of fancy molecules that the plants produce that are beneficial to our health. So I'm sure you know about flavonoids and terpenoids and polyphenols. I mean, these are all really important metabolites that plants produce. They produce them to protect themselves from disease, including from insects and from fungus. But they're also, when we eat the plants, we eat those molecules, and they help to protect ourselves as well. They're very good antioxidants, and they can help with the mitochondrial function. They're very, very nutritious. And they come a lot of them come from the herbs, you know, so we have so many herbs that are touted as being very healthful. And I try to eat a lot of herbs. And when cooking, we use a lot of herbs and spices for that reason, because they have so many super nutrients that can help keep you healthy. And all of those come out of that shikimate pathway. So it's the pathway is extremely important in bacteria as well. And many of our gut microbes have the pathway, have the enzyme in particular in the pathway that glyphosate disrupts, which is called EPSP synthase. When that enzyme is blocked, the microbes get sick, but also they're unable to produce adequate amounts of aromatic amino acids, which come out of that, directly out of that pathway. And the aromatic amino acids are three of the coding amino acids for the protein. So that becomes a very serious problem with protein synthesis if they're deficient. But they're also precursors to a huge number of incredibly important molecules in our body, including the hormones and neurotransmitters, so serotonin, melatonin, the skin tanning agent melanin, thyroid hormone, various B vitamins. Melanin and melatonin, both of them. So melatonin is sort of a defective melatonin is associated with sleep disorder. Sleep disorder is one of the conditions that's going up dramatically in our society, in step with the rise in glyphosate usage on core crops. And in my book, I talk about a large number of diseases. One of the things that I did in collaboration with other researchers was to look at the data on disease trends over time, and looking for diseases that are going up dramatically over time, and then seeing how well they correlate with the rise in glyphosate usage on core crops. And it's actually stunning to see how many diseases are going up dramatically. And you can see obesity, because we have a huge problem with obesity in this country today. Diabetes, obesity, Alzheimer's, autism, ADHD, inflammatory gut, liver, fatty liver disease, thyroid cancer, pancreatic cancer. These are all diseases that are going up dramatically, exactly in step with the rise in glyphosate usage on core crops. And people say immediately, oh, correlation doesn't mean causation. And then they say, how could one chemical cause so many diseases? And I try to address both of those claims in my book. And I explain in my book how glyphosate could cause individual diseases through its insidious mechanism of toxicity, which I think is unique to glyphosate. And it has to do with it being an amino acid analog of glycine. Glycine is the smallest amino acid, very, very important in many proteins, plays a critical role. And there are many experiments that show if you swap out a single glycine in a certain protein, you completely disable its ability to do its job. So I think glyphosate is getting into proteins by mistake in place of glycine. And that is how you can explain how it could be causing all of those diseases. It's really quite fascinating science, because you can rummage through the research literature to find out which proteins have these critical glycine residues. And you can find which proteins are causal in various diseases to find that a defect in that protein causes this disease, and then to show that glyphosate could cause that defect by substituting for glycine. It's a giant jigsaw puzzle, but it works out extremely well, in my opinion, and I write about it in my book.
One of the more tenuous arguments that no one in the media wants to touch, they simply want to bury it or deny it, and they've attacked you personally on this, is the connection between Roundup, glyphosate, of course, and neurological problems, even mental cognitive functions, and therefore glyphosate could contribute to autism with or without vaccines or other toxic environmental chemicals. And what do we know now about the herbicide disrupting neurological and cognitive performance? Perhaps the disease most people are familiar with would be cancer, but there are many more. And on that, we have been only addressing human health. Glyphosate is having a devastating impact on the environment and ecosystems and biodiversity, other species and water systems, the rapid loss of honeybees by neonicotinoids, and other crucial pollinators is just one example. What has been the overall impact of widespread glyphosate used by farmers on the larger environmental landscape?
You always ask very big questions. So, and, you know, I didn't finish up on the other question because you asked about the vaccines and COVID-19. And actually, I've said a lot about that in other interviews because I believe that glyphosate exposure is a primary factor in judging how well a given country can cope with COVID-19. When you look around the world at the countries that are having the hardest time trying to control COVID, you will see that those are the same countries that use a lot of glyphosate. It's quite remarkable. And countries where glyphosate is not really, you know, for example, Bhutan has mostly small organic farms. They have had, I think, a handful of deaths total. I think last I checked, it was three. I mean, practically no deaths from COVID-19 in Bhutan. If you have a healthy immune system, then you can resist COVID-19 and you won't spread the virus as well as if you don't have a healthy immune system. That's when the virus multiplies in your body and then it spreads. And so I have a chapter in my book about glyphosate and the immune system, and I show how I think glyphosate is disrupting the immune system and causing people to be sensitive to COVID-19 and also probably to the vaccines for the same reason, because you need a strong immune system to be able to handle all that spike protein that's being produced by those vaccines. So that's an answer to that piece of the other question. And now I want to go on to this question, which is sort of the neurological disease. Autism is actually a very complex disease, and it does begin in the gut. Many, many autistic kids have issues with their gut, inflammatory gut, leaky gut, bloating, you know, gas, these kinds of problems, diarrhea, constipation, lots and lots of trouble with their gut. And I think that the critical thing to heal these diseases is you have to start with fixing the gut. And that, of course, involves eating certified organic. I think that's number one, eating certified organic. The other thing that glyphosate does is it messes up the sulfur system. And I talk a lot about that in my book as well. And the sulfur system is messed up in autism. That's been shown even since the 1990s. Rosemary Waring was an important contributor to the research literature showing that autistic kids they flush sulfate through the urine, even though they have low sulfate in their blood. So they have a deficiency in sulfate systemically. And sulfate is super, super important, both in the blood, you know, to maintain the zeta potential. Sulfate provides negative charge in the membranes of the red blood cells, which allows them to repel each other so they don't glom together. And so sulfate also lines all the blood vessels and provides negative charge there, which is also very important for the circulation. So zeta potential is a measure of the amount of negative charge around the suspended particles in the blood, which includes the red blood cells, but also the LDL particles, you know, all the stuff that's in the blood, the exosomes that are being released by the cells, all these things are in the blood. And if they don't have enough negative charge, that becomes a problem for blood circulation. And so so glyphosate messes up the sulfate system in multiple ways. And I talk about it in my book, the synthesis of sulfate, the attachment of sulfate to other molecules, the transport of sulfate, the delivery of sulfate, and the transfer once the sulfate arrives to the extracellular matrix to protect that cell from other things. I mean, that's another thing sulfate does. It creates gelled water around a particle by putting sulfate in the membrane of the particle. It creates gelled water, which provides isolation that keeps the particle safe from oxidative and glycation damage. So all these things are going wrong. Another thing is the mitochondria. The mitochondria are getting hit hard by glyphosate. So they're unable to make enough ATP. They also produce too much reactive oxygen species, which end up damaging the cells. So the neurons, of course, are very sensitive to oxidative damage. And the neurons are deficient in sulfate as well, which also interferes with their ability to clear garbage. Sulfate is important for clearing garbage. It provides the buffer to make the low pH that's needed in the lysosomes to be able to break down debris. And when that gets stalled, you get things like Alzheimer's too, with the buildup of all these misfolded proteins. So I think that impaired mitochondrial function, which is to produce energy for the cell, and impaired lysosomal function, which is to clear the garbage. Both of those are chronic in our society because of chronic glyphosate exposure, and other chemicals as well, of course, affect those things. But those are central for the cells to be healthy. And of course, after a long time, you end up with cancer when those conditions are going on steadily over a long period of time and getting worse. The cell becomes a tumor cell. So you get neurological diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, autoimmune diseases, cancer, all these different chronic diseases that we're seeing today, I think are consequence of the slow erosion of our health. And at the basis, it's the mitochondria getting sick and the lysosomes getting sick. And then that's causing the cells to function very badly, and including the immune cells, which means they're unable to clear viruses.
That answers the question. In fact, any final thoughts of what we should be doing today, since our government officials, the media, and most of the scientific community are not helping to resolve the issue of glyphosate, as well as any of the other pesticides that are being used?
Right. I mean, as I've said, buy certified organic, eat certified organic, tell your friends, tell your family, eat certified organic, really get that message out, because I think that's number one, actually. If we refuse to buy the food, then they won't make it. And the farmers, of course, are being harmed by the chemicals as well. So they should want to convert to organic. There are people who are working hard on figuring out how to grow food efficiently without using chemicals. And I really applaud those efforts. Anybody who, a young person coming up and trying to decide what career should I have, if they can think of buying a piece of land and creating an organic farm, I think it's the very best that they could do for the world. I think it's the most important thing people need to be thinking about right now, is to get back to the point where we can grow our food through small organic farms. So I really admire those people. I know it's a lot of work and it's hard, but we need to admit that we have to spend more money on food. We have to hire people to help get rid of the weeds. There are, in fact, technology may help. And I know people who are developing robotic tractors, you know, that can run on solar energy and that can have a vision. They can actually go and find weeds and they can kill them with hot water, you know, this kind of thing. So there could be a way to solve the weed problem organically through the use of technology. And I think that's quite exciting. And I'm hoping that we will eventually come up with solutions of that sort, because we need to think very much in terms of reducing toxic chemical exposures. And of course, as you said, glyphosate is not the only one. There are so many others. There's a whole question with the EMFs as well, which are growing rapidly with the rollout of 5G. It's another one of those things where we don't know. And there are people who are shouting the alarm, and other people are saying, well, they're just crying wolf. And that's kind of the situation we're in, where people have a hard time believing that something could be so toxic when they become so comfortable with it. And that's what's happened with glyphosate. We've been told that it's a wonderful chemical, non-toxic to humans. And it's so pervasive in our environment, with the government being so happy to let us just keep on increasing the amount every year, that we don't, it's a level of disbelief to say, oh my God, this thing is actually very toxic. It's very hard for people to believe that that's true. And yet they really need to, in order to save us from disaster. And part of what I talk about in my book is the damage it's doing to insects. And I do believe glyphosate's a major player in the bee colony collapse syndrome. We see the bees just getting decimated every year. Neonicotinoids are, of course, a direct hit because they kill insects. But glyphosate makes the neonicotinoids much more toxic than they would otherwise be, because it disrupts the enzymes in the liver that detox the neonicotinoids and also many other chemicals that we're exposed to. So glyphosate disrupts the detox system, which makes the other chemicals more toxic. that's a real snowball effect, synergistic effect among different chemicals. So, so eating certified organic, if you can grow certified organic, even to grow food in your own yard or to have a plot of land where you grow tomatoes, I mean, it would be awesome for people to get back to thinking in terms of growing their own food as much as possible. And then to become an organic farmer, if you have that inclination, do it, because it's very, very important. And of course, if people have a stomach for it, harass the government. I find it very, very difficult to do anything with the government because it's so frustrating. But some people have the stomach for it. And if they do, definitely please do that. And locally, it's a lot easier. People have had good success locally in getting glyphosate banned in public places in their city or in the schoolyards. You know, you should really look in to see if the kids are getting exposed to glyphosate at school. And if so, then you need to talk to the local government, try to get that stopped. And I think that's there's a lot more likelihood of success with those kinds of projects as compared to confronting the central government, because the U.S. government has been so severely bought. They just seem to be immune to any kind of information that might show them the truth about this chemical.
I want to end today's program by doing a little commentary and then your final thoughts on what I'm about to say, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1971, I purchased a small, rough piece of farmland upstate New York, and I called it the Fertiller Farm. It was the first teaching organic farm in New York State. In fact, the first food co-op, the High Falls Food Co-op, I started up there. And what I found was, and here are some of the lessons, that there was a lot of interest by young people who had been socially active, politically active, who now saw, okay, we had gotten out of Vietnam or would be getting out of Vietnam. They had spent a lot of years fighting that. There were also people who had been fighting on behalf of the women's movement, the gay movement, the human rights movement. I remember all the problems in front of trying to get people to come down to the South African embassy to challenge apartheid. But when I mentioned to my radio audience that anyone interested in learning about getting back to the land, no matter where you live, no matter if you live in Manhattan, come up on a weekend, we had thousands and thousands of people over a 15-year period who came up there. And we would teach them all about soil and the bacteria in the soil. And I'm a vegan, so animal husbandry, where we would rescue animals instead of killing them and eating them. And I gave an example. I said, here is a place called Stone Ridge. Now, what can you do in Stone Ridge? So there were some people walking around. They say, nothing. I mean, it's all, you know, you touch the ground, you're touching rock. I said, that's true, but let's look at solutions, because some of you are going to be buying land, and you got to know how to buy land, how to farm land, so that you don't end up having everything go bad or the animals eat it, and then you get discouraged thinking this was a stupid idea, and then leave and never come back. So I showed him there was a pond, and drain the pond, take all that muck that's really rich in powerful nutrients out of it, let it drain, just tobacco can do it, and or a dredging machine, and which was not expensive, and then that became the topsoil. So it's that topsoil allowed everything to grow. And then I showed him how to put up fencing and put human hair around the fencing that keeps the deers out. So in any case, it was okay. Now you've seen how to grow food. Now let's go out here, because it's a really bad winters up here, and dig a hole 3 foot down, 3 foot wide, 3 foot square. Now insulate it, and there's natural insulation. You can use bale hay to insulate it, and about a foot of insulation. Then put topsoil in. And I just kept saying this. Everywhere in America, people are planting things, but they're not understanding how to plant them. I gave an example. Down in Florida, a person will put a big palm tree in a little hole and throw one coffee can of mill organite as a fertilizer on it. Okay, now the plant, that's all the food it's got, and it's a sandy loamy soil, not a lot of minerals. I said, dig a hole 6 feet by 6 feet, fill it all up with healthy topsoil, and that's rich in microorganisms, and then put your tree in. That way it has an enormous amount of nutrition that it will be drawing from as it develops its villi on its root system. And sure enough, one of the people did that, and there was a storm in Florida, and this person came up in the second year and said, all my neighbor's trees died because we got a 23-degree cold day down in Florida, and everything went dead. Mine didn't. I said, no, because the energy goes in a plant, a tree or a shrub, it goes into the root system. So cut it back so the root system is nourished and just keep fertilizing the root system. Instead of fertilizing it once a year, fertilize it every 2 weeks. And so thousands of people began to take these ideas of what they could do and where were the best places that would be sustainable. Back then, we didn't talk about sustainability as much. Today, we have to talk about sustainability because there are places that may be wonderful from the past, great venues, great views. Look at Lake Tahoe today. It's burning to the ground. 22,000 homes at risk of all being destroyed. Last night, the fire was 5 miles away from Lake Tahoe. The lake is beautiful, but no one thought, am I in the wrong place at the wrong time? And look at New York City. Look at people living in apartments that were below street level, or basement apartments. Seven of them died last night. They were drowned in their own apartment, couldn't get out. Who would have thought, right? That had never happened before. So you've got to now look at, am I in the right place at the right time with the right support system with the right idea, and are you the right person? And so from those humble beginnings, a lot of people then took those ideas back. And I had a visitor regularly. Have you ever heard of Scott and Helen Nearing, the Nearings?
I don't think so.
They were both academics, but then they made most of their reputation was living close to nature and showing how you get off the grid and be self-sufficient. They were very big in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And we had a lot of conversations together about, protecting your bees. And I just put bales of hay up above the beehive. And then I did triple bales. And then I put heat sticks down. So I didn't lose any of the bees. And all these other people all over America, the bees are just dying. And then it gets, to where you can end up losing a whole hive. And I also said, don't take honey. Leave the honey and then feed the honey back to the bees every day when there's nothing for pollination and where they can't go out and find any food. In any case, people learned. Now, at about 1985, that whole movement kind of stopped. I mean, it just stopped. People kind of said, okay, well, we did our farm thing and our back-to-the-earth thing and our organic thing. So if they wanted organic, they went to a health food store or farmer's market. Now, and this is the part of this story that I think is interesting, now you have millions of Americans, especially younger people, who want to get off the grid, get out of their apartments or homes or parents' places, and get back to the land and live a more simple life. We're getting into the slow movement and the minimalist movement, and organic and sustainability is a big part of that. That's what I see happening, and I see it big time, bigger than in the 1970s. Your thoughts, please.
That's awesome. Yes, I've been noticing that too, and I really applaud that effort. I think it's very, very exciting. And there also are researchers learning how to do agriculture right in terms of renewable agriculture so that every year the soil is stronger than it was the year before. We really should pay attention to what you're doing to the soil when you grow your crop. And of course, there's simple things like putting a cover crop in over the winter. In fact, researchers in that field have shown how you can grow crops organically without spending tons of money. And in the end, you're also capturing carbon and bringing it into the soil, which is helping climate change, as well as renewing the soil and making it healthier, which makes the crop healthier, which makes the food healthier. Everything is good. There's nothing bad about that. And I think it's a very exciting time to get into that field. And it really becomes a research issue at this point because we've lost the art of growing food naturally. We need to bring it back. And I think we can probably learn a lot from the farmers in Africa and in Bhutan that are still growing foods that way. We could learn, re-educate ourselves on how to grow food economically and in a way that does not require toxic chemicals. And that, of course, includes synthetic fertilizers like the phosphate and nitrate fertilizers. Those are not good either. the whole system of food growing in this country needs to be completely, really abolished. And we need to start over with this concept of small organic farms. And if there can be a large number of young people who decide that's what they want and they're determined to do it, I think it's awesome. And I think it's going to save us from other, what is otherwise a very bleak future.
And now they'll be moving to those states that are more sustainable because they're not drought states, flood states, hurricane states, earthquake states, and fire states. And we have about 22 of them. And I did an 8-hour webinar on this just 2 weeks ago. But anyhow, we're out of time. And all the final word was on that box that I built with a simple glass cover with a simple little 125-watt light bulb in the middle of 3 foot of snow. I opened it up and showed that you have all this lettuce growing in this greenhouse that was in the ground. And now we have hydroponics, so we don't have to do what I did. We can go forward. Thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Stephanie Seneff, a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And her website is stephaneseneff.net. Thank you all for listening to Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Noll. Have a nice day.